A little bit of the Fed, some inflation, immigration policy as well, and race cars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Friday, the 14th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Congress is back in Washington. The Fed chair was on Capitol Hill. We were introduced to Maganomics this week. So much to talk about, so little time. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post are in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, quick thoughts on the substance of Chair Yellen's testimony?
She basically told us what we already knew, that the Fed is going to continue raising rates, although a little more slowly, it sounded like, than had been expected.
Okay. So, Lee, let me get to the parlor game part of this thing. The subtext, the subtext rather, of discussions of the Federal Reserve these days is about what happens in January when her term as chair is up. Rumor has it that the president is not going to reappoint her. There are some names being floated. Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council at the White House, is one of them. What happens substantively if the Fed chair changes?
Well, it depends who's put in place. I think that if it were Gary Cohn, I think that the market would probably like that. It would be seen as this is one of our own. He's from Goldman. This is change. I think, and there's probably a thought that he would keep the good times flowing. But I think, you know, he's not an academic. He would be the first non-academic in four decades. And that's a big deal. I mean, you know, academics, economists, and business people are two very different types. Yep. And it's often assumed that there's, you know, that they do the same thing. They absolutely do not. It's like a surgeon and a butcher. It's like very, they seem the same, but they're not. I mean, you know, I'm not saying which one would be which, but but it's okay, different. It would be very different.
All you economists out there, let's keep those cards and letters coming. Catherine, I mean, when Lee says keep the good times going, so if Gary Cohn gets this job, he's going to presumably keep interest rates low? Is that sort of the inference there?
We don't know what he would do. Trump himself has said that he likes low interest rates. You know, there's certainly a temptation for someone who is too in hock to the administration to try to be to like play the Phillips curve, right? Like to try to boost input in the short term and keep the good times flowing, as Lee put it. Yeah. You know, not take the punch bowl away, which nobody wants to be the bad guy to do. But if you know the long history of the importance of Fed independence, of understanding the trade-offs between unemployment and stable prices, inflation, then you know that sometimes you have to do that. So I think that it's a big wild card, but it's part of the reason why some of the more traditional candidates, you know, Republican economists, for example, might not be at the top of Trump's list because they're a little more hawkish. They're, you know, certainly than Yellen. They might be more likely to want to take the punch bowl away.
Right. That is to say, raise rates. We did a whole thing on the Phillips curve about a month ago, by the way. We'll put it on the website, obviously, marketplace.org. Lee, let me move on to this idea from Mick Mulvaney, the head of the OMB the other day, coming out in the Wall Street Journal with a piece that I think was headlined, Introducing Maganomics, Make America Great Again, Nomics. The upshot of the whole thing is that the Trump administration is planning and basing its entire economic plan on growing this economy at 3%. We are so far away from that. It's not even like in the same ballpark. How do they get there?
It's short of a miracle, it's hard to see how, because productivity has slowed so much and the labor force growth is in decline. And so it's very hard to achieve that with those two things. And so it doesn't mean that people won't really seize on that number and cheer it. You know, I mean, I think a lot of this is sort of just trumpeting big grand plans. And sure, we all want that. It would be fantastic. But it's just very hard to see how we get there.
Catherine, your thoughts on 3% growth and how we get from here to there?
Ridiculous.
Not going to happen. Is that a technical op-ed writer, opinion columnist?
And that's an economic term, actually. It's so unlikely at this point. There are certain things you can do at the margin, right, to try to increase productivity growth, to try to increase GDP growth. But the gap is so wide between where we are now and where the Trump administration proclaims we will be. And it's not just me saying that this is impractical, right? It's the CBO. We actually had a CBO report this week where they looked at the growth. Well, among other things, they talked about the growth projections that they're expecting versus what the Trump administration has laid out. It's, you know, Moody's. It's various other independent analysts, economists, outfits, whatever, looking at this and saying, you know, just the fundamentals aren't there in large part because of our demographic challenges and because of these long term,
trends in the
productivity.
Economy, yeah. And exactly. also the lingering 10 years on after effects of the financial crisis, right?
That certainly doesn't help.
Yeah. Catherine Rampell is at The Washington Post. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thanks.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, started strong, ended stronger. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Talking about the Fed and what it thinks about this economy, we got the monthly report on consumer prices today. Inflation is another way to say that. Pretty weak in June. Overall, inflation was flat from a month earlier. Core prices, that is without food and energy, assuming you don't need to drive or heat your home or eat, was up just a 0.1%. That is lower than analysts had guessed and, more important, lower than the Fed's inflation target for this economy, which is 2%. But it is fair to ask, since it gets so very much attention, why do we want more inflation, rising prices in this economy anyway? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
More inflation. You got to think nobody wants that. Not business owners like Kyle Hewlings, who owns a gourmet salad cart in Portland, Oregon, and says his ingredient costs have gone up, but
I've hesitated to raise my prices, and nobody likes asking for more money.
Not consumers like Kristen Ingbrand, a bartender who was eating a waffle sandwich that cost $9.50.
I think everything's expensive right now.
Do you ever want prices to go up?
To go up? No.
but economists would like to see a bit more inflation served up right now. Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says it's good when we have
the hot economy driving inflation. This is kind of a straightforward story. Suppose that you're thinking of taking a job at Walmart.
And, like now, unemployment's low and lots of other stores are looking for workers.
And that means if Walmart wants to hire you, they're going to have to offer a higher wage. Well, that gets passed on in prices, more inflation.
A moderate, predictable rate of inflation also encourages investment. A family buying a new house, a business buying a new machine. Higher wages and prices will help pay off the principal and interest on the loan. Notice I said moderate and predictable, not out of control. William Poole was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis and remembers when inflation soared in the late 70s.
The public hated it. It produced a great deal of instability in the economy. And we ended up with a very steep recession.
Also not good, super low inflation or even deflation, because then people stop buying things. They figure the price they see today might be even lower tomorrow. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A couple of three big Wall Street banks, JP Morgan, Citigroup, PNC, and Wells Fargo, and yes, I know that was four, reported earnings today. All of them beat expectations. JP Morgan especially, which posted its best quarter ever. The bump comes in part in the form of higher interest rates after three straight rate hikes by the Federal Reserve. But the banks aren't paying out more on regular old-fashioned deposits. Peanuts, really, that 0.1% you earn on your checking or savings account, which can mean curious things for cash, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
U.S. banks are going to great lengths these days to basically encourage customers to keep their cash. I mean, the interest on deposits is basically zero.
You know, it's not worthless, but banks have plenty of deposits right now.
Jim Sinegal is an analyst with Morningstar. He says the lack of demand for loans in recent years means banks are flush with deposits. One of the questions going forward is, will customers keep parking their money in those underperforming bank accounts?
As rates start to go up, are they going to start looking for higher rates, or are they going to hold off for a while in hopes of even higher rates in the future?
In the meantime, as the Fed raises rates on their end, banks can charge more for loans without paying more for deposits. Not too shabby, right?
Absolutely. Most of that is going to go right to the bottom line for banks.
Steve Bigger is an analyst with Argus Research. He says those in search of higher returns can always look to the stock market.
And of course, there's some internet banks out there that are paying quite a bit more deposit yields than do the major banks.
While bank earnings are up and cash is cheap, it's not exactly all good news for banks, says Devin Ryan of JMP Securities.
You know, most banks would prefer an environment where there's strong economic growth and there's a lot of demand for various types of loans. That's generally a healthier type of backdrop.
After another Fed rate hike or two, Ryan says banks should start competing for deposits again relatively soon. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We started a series earlier this week about jobs that are more than just jobs. They're tied to a place or a culture, to a generation of workers, maybe jobs that have become a way of life. Take, just because it's summertime, the matches you might well use to fire up your grill this summer. For years, diamond matches have been made in Cloquet, Minnesota, the last wooden matchstick factory in this country. But the factory is closing. Pretty big deal in a town that bills itself as the City of Wood Industries. Dan Crocker from Minnesota Public Radio has this latest installment of our series, Way of Life.
Here's just how tightly the wood products industry is woven into the community fabric of Cloquet. Back in the 1950s, employees from a local mill helped build the town's hospital that still stands today. And those employees
were able to take payroll deduction to buy shares in the hospital.
Those shares aren't worth anything, says Marshall Johnson, who worked at the big paper mill in Cloquet for 45 years. But Johnson, who's now mayor of the tiny town of Scanlon right next to Cloquet, says workers were allowed to serve on the hospital's board of directors.
They've always been involved in contributing to the welfare of the city. They're involved in the school board, involved in United Way.
And those jobs at the paper mill or the matchstick plant or the factory that makes ceiling tiles, those jobs, says Johnson, are part of families for generations.
I've had two grandfathers that worked for the mills. My uncle worked for the mills. I and two of my brothers worked for the mills.
And now one of his daughters works at the mill, operating the same paper machine he used to run. That's why it was such a big blow to Cloquet when the news came that the match factory is closing.
There's a lot of concern. There's a lot of emotion.
Steve Padaletti is president of the United Steelworkers Local 970 Union. He says some employees at the match factory have never done anything else.
You operate a lathe, you've operated a match machine. Coming into the computerized industry now is a big change for them.
New Jersey-based Newell Brands recently sold the Diamond Match brand, but the new owner didn't want the Cloquet factory, so 85 employees are losing their jobs. It's a familiar story. Over the past 10 years, jobs in wood product manufacturing in Minnesota have dropped by more than 30%. Paper mill jobs have been cut by more than 20%. But despite those trends, there's optimism in Cloquet. In fact, you can find it right across the street from the match factory. 5,500 tons of wood are processed every day here at the Sappy Mill. Logs are chipped and turned into pulp inside giant pressure cookers. But that pulp isn't just used to make paper anymore. 4 years ago, Sappy converted its mill to also be able to make a product called specialized cellulose.
Here's the final product coming off the pulp dryer into the bales.
Mill director Mike Schultz says the cellulose is shipped overseas where it's used to make fabrics like rayon. With the paper market declining, Schultz says Sappy wanted to diversify.
That was about $170, $180 million investment. You don't see investments like that in our industry, in particular in North America, very much anymore.
Still, Sappy has had to cut jobs to remain competitive. 15 years ago, the mill employed more than 1,000 workers. Now it's at 685. But those jobs pay really well, about $55,000 a year to start. Cloquet Community Development Director Holly Hansen wants to keep those jobs and perhaps lure a new company into the match factory.
I do know that some wood product industry companies are touring it. I think the question is, does it fit their needs?
But even if it doesn't, Hansen hopes Cloquet will hang on to its industrial legacy that's been here for over a century. In Cloquet, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The world is going in this direction, so the racing world obviously had to follow it.
Obviously. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, another record high this Friday, up 84 points, 0.3%, 21,637. NASDAQ up 38 points, 0.6%, 63.12. The S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.4%, 24.59. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow is up 1%, S&P 500 up 1.4%, NASDAQ up 2.6%. Banks, though, not reaching any highs today. Down across the board, despite those better-than-expected earnings we told you about. J.P. Morgan dipped 0.9%. Bank of America down 1.6% today. Goldman gave Walmart a vote of confidence, saying it's not super worried about competition from Amazon. Walmart up 1.7% today. Amazon, little increase, up about 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.33%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Politico reported this week that the White House is working with two Republican members of the Senate on an immigration bill, specifically a bill to cut legal immigration to the United States in half by 2027. That's in line with the president's campaign promises, but it would be in direct opposition to another promise. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
Senators Tom Cotton of Arkansas and David Perdue of Georgia are behind the bill. It's an expansion of the RAISE Act they introduced back in February. At their press conference, Cotton said,
"This generation-long surge in low-skilled immigration has hurt blue-collar wages. It's pulling the rug out from underneath them."
The bill would focus on restricting low-skill workers who come to join family already here. Alex Narasta is an immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute. He disagrees.
There's almost nothing to these claims.
And he says stemming the flow of immigrants to the U.S. could be in direct opposition to another Trump promise, growing the economy.
By restricting the supply of future immigrants come in, they're also limiting demand.
For things like the goods and services they buy.
There is no society that we can find in the history of the world that has accelerating economic growth and a falling population.
Michael Clemens is with the Center for Global Development. He recently co-published a paper looking at historical efforts to staunch the flow of legal immigrants. Chinese workers in the 1880s, Italians in the 1920s, and Mexicans in the 1960s.
And the argument every time was that this is going to create jobs for U.S. workers, raise wages for U.S. workers. There's no evidence in any of these historical cases and others that that actually happened.
He says in the 60s, Mexican farm workers were replaced by machines, not Americans. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Today, in little-known facts about this country's transportation infrastructure, naps, snoozes, and how they will be no more at CSX. When he took over this spring, the new CEO of the railroad company got rid of a 20 or so year practice that allowed crews to nap under certain circumstances. Getting rid of those naps, the company says, will improve efficiency and reduce delays. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports that naps are a real actual topic of discussion in various transportation industries.
Freight trains can get hung up for several reasons. Many of the freight lines in the U.S. are single track, according to Larry Gross, a consultant with FTR Transportation Intelligence.
So when you have trains that are traveling in opposite directions, one of the trains needs to pull into a short section of double track, which is known as a passing siding, to allow the opposing train to pass.
That could take an hour or more, or a train could get delayed due to track maintenance. For many engineers and conductors in the industry, that's a time to catch 40 winks. Union Pacific Railroad even has nap rooms. But as CSX tries to make operations more efficient and reduce train delays, it says naps are now off the table. Rail consultant Jim Blaze thinks the move is unwise.
You are putting economics before safety.
The National Transportation Safety Board says fatigue played a role in about 20% of nearly 200 investigations between 2001 and 2012. But there's a big debate about napping in rail, aviation, and trucking. Ian Savage is an expert in the economics of transportation at Northwestern University.
Some of the issues that come up in all these forms of transportation are, first of all, you know, are you allowed to nap at your workplace or do you have to go somewhere else to nap?
And if it's not the right length, will the nap help? CSX says safety has not suffered since naps were banned in April under its new CEO, Hunter Harrison. Canadian Pacific, which Harrison used to run, also bans snoozing on the job. That company says it's up to employees to come to work rested. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
One of the hot tickets in New York City this weekend is what's being billed as an E-Prix. It's a riff on Grand Prix, as in Formula One car races, but with electric cars. The series, which has made stops in Hong Kong, Buenos Aires, and Monaco, to name just a couple of big-time cities, is drawing the world's best drivers and tens of millions of dollars in investment from car makers that say that's going to help them bring their electric cars to the wider market. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
Formula E's racetrack looks like something out of an arcade game. A 1.2-mile loop of asphalt surrounded by blue walls with a grandstand and a view of downtown Manhattan and the Statue of Liberty. On a weekday afternoon, the race cars, brightly colored in blue, red, white, and purple, are arriving, packed into freight containers off a boat after a previous race in Berlin. This weekend, 20 drivers will compete here over 2 days in front of an expected 40,000 spectators. Antonio Felix da Costa from Portugal is one of the drivers.
It's amazing to be racing in this city.
Da Costa's been racing since he was 8 years old, starting in a go-kart. He's won prestigious races in gas-powered cars, like the Macau Grand Prix. Now he's racing an electric car for the race car team Andretti Autosport.
The world is going green. The world is going in this direction, so the racing world obviously had to follow it.
The world is going green. China and Europe are imposing tougher emission standards for cars. Cities like Paris, Madrid, and Athens have announced that they'll ban diesel cars from their city centers by 2025. As the regulations pile up, automakers are hustling to develop electric fleets, and they're doing it, in part, through Formula E. The car companies BMW, Jaguar, Audi, and Renault are all participating in the series, building cars and sponsoring teams. The races give them a chance to pilot their new electric technology under grueling conditions and see how it measures up. Justin Goduto is an executive for Audi.
You know, nothing pushes innovation and development better than competition.
Goduto says racing has always played a big role in Audi's R&D process. The difference now? Audi, which has a fully electric SUV in the works, sees electric cars as the future. So it's shifting investment from gas-powered racing circuits to Formula E.
What series makes sense for us to best learn, understand, develop, you know, test, and implement? I think Formula E is the right space for us.
The car maker Jaguar, which will launch its own fully electric car next year, has devoted its entire global motorsports budget to the racing series. James Barclay is the team director.
From a product perspective, obviously electric vehicles play an incredibly important part of our future.
Thing is, that future is still a while away.
The electric vehicle market gets a lot of publicity, but it's, at the moment, it's very tiny.
Michelle Krebs, an analyst at Auto Trader, says in the first half of this year, fewer than 1% of new cars sold in the U.S. were electric. And that's another reason car companies are joining Formula E, to expand the market for electric cars.
There's this idea that they aren't very fun, they are slow, and so a racing series can bust some myths about electric vehicles.
And because Formula E holds its races in city centers, it gives the automakers a chance to show off their green credentials to young, sustainability-minded urbanites, the same people who'd be likely to buy those electric cars when they do come to market. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, picking up on our story earlier about Wall Street banks and their profits, JP Morgan in particular. One of the things that happens on earnings day is that bank executives get on a couple of conference calls with analysts and reporters and they share their thoughts. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, blistered political Washington for gridlock and inaction on his calls this morning. And separately, he said this.
If this administration can make breakthroughs in taxes and infrastructure regulatory reform, we have become one of the most bureaucratic, confusing, litigious societies on the planet. It's almost an embarrassment being an American citizen traveling around the world and listening to the stupid shit we have to deal with in this country. And, you know, at one point, we all have to get our act together or we won't do what we're supposed to do for the average Americans.
Happy Friday, everybody. We have, I should say, invited Mr. Dimon on this program more times than I can count. He is still welcome whenever he'd like to come. All right, we're gone. The Dow up 84 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ up 38 points, 0.6%. S&P 500 up 11, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Saturn Yeves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.